From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's International Women's Day, and on today's Fresh Air, we look at women in the Catholic Church and the politics of motherhood. We'll talk with Mary Jo Weaver about the dilemmas faced by feminists who are Catholic. Some are trying to reform the church from within, while others are creating new alternatives. And we talk with Mary Frances Berry about the assumption that women should be the primary caretakers of children. Her new book is about childcare and women's rights. And one of the women's movement's most influential books is back in print. Maureen Corrigan rereads The Dialectics of Sex. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House said today that President Clinton has agreed to further deep cuts in his spending proposals. The agreement came out of a meeting today with members of the House Budget Committee. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Members of the House Budget Committee say they're looking for another $50 billion in spending cuts over the next 5 years. While some spending reductions would be achieved by trimming programs, other savings are also being sought in the $153 billion in investments proposed by the president. House Budget Director Leon Panetta says lawmakers may consider stretching out funding proposed for research and development and technology investment over the next 5 years, but he warned against cutting back on social programs such as Head Start. The budget resolution, which both the House and Senate are rushing to pass this week, is merely a blueprint which will be filled in later by the Tax Writing and Appropriations Committees. But the White House is optimistic about eventual passage of the president's economic package because members of the Budget Committee are sticking largely to the established framework instead of offering their own alternatives. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Federal employees' unions called on the Clinton administration today to cut management positions in its efforts to reduce the federal payroll by 100,000 jobs. A spokeswoman for the American Federation of Government Employees told the Associated Press that her union agrees the government could be smaller and more effective. The spokeswoman, Janice Lachance, said the federal government has one manager for every six employees, a far greater ratio of managers than in any private sector business. The president of the Senior Employees Association disputed that figure. Carol Bonasaro said that many federal agencies look as if they have a lot of managers because government scientists and lawyers have management-level classifications even if they don't supervise other employees. In New York, workers are using a large crane to scoop debris out of the bombed-out parking garage of the World Trade Center. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
FBI officials said today there could be more arrests in the case by the end of the week. Authorities last week arrested Mohammed Salama, a 25-year-old Jordanian citizen, and charged him with involvement in the bombing. Authorities say a second man, in custody for obstructing justice, may also be involved. Investigators are now searching for some of Salama's alleged accomplices. Over the weekend, police searched two apartments in Jersey City, New Jersey. They questioned a man living in one of them, but made no arrests. At the World Trade Center, workers are now trying to remove 2,500 tons of rubble from the floor of the parking garage where the bomb went off. Officials say they will remove the debris by the truckload to be studied by forensic experts. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 65 points to close at a record 3,469. This is NPR. The Forest Service reported today that it lost $50 million on its timber sales program in 1992. The Forest Service sells timber from national forests to private contractors. In its yearly report, the service said that its revenues on the sales exceeded its costs by $255 million. At the same time, though, the service was obliged to pay more than $305 million in revenue sharing to states and counties. The Clinton administration wants to save $274 million over the next 4 years by phasing out below-cost timber sales. Federal prosecutors in Germany have filed murder charges against two men who admitted to carrying out an arson attack against foreigners last November. A Turkish woman and two Turkish children died in the attack. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
25-year-old Michael Peters and 19-year-old Lars Christensen, who were arrested several days after the attack, are charged with murder and arson. The firebombing in Moon, which caused three deaths and numerous injuries, was one of the most severe cases of violence against foreigners in past months in Germany. The incident stirred international outrage and prompted the Bonn government to start banning extremist right-wing parties. A federal court in Germany today also upheld prison sentences between 3.5 and 5 years in a similar firebombing incident from 1991. Three young men were convicted of throwing firebombs into the window of a refugee home in the town of Hunxia, severely injuring two Lebanese children. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Agency said today that tropical forests are being destroyed at a much higher rate than they were 10 years ago. The survey said that the ecologically important forests are being lost at a rate that's 40% higher than it was in 1980. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Is it possible to be a feminist and a Catholic? How can you be faithful to your belief in equal rights while following a religion in which women cannot be ordained and cannot even use birth control? This is a question Mary Jo Weaver wrestles with. She's Catholic and a professor of religious studies and women's studies at Indiana University. Her book, New Catholic Women, examined how women were trying to change the patriarchal structure of the church. Her new book, Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today, looks at women who are attempting to reform the church from within and women who have left the church in despair and are seeking spiritual fulfillment elsewhere. Some of those who have left have gone to the other extreme and become goddess worshippers. I asked Weaver to explain neo-paganism and her interest in it.
I am most interested in the problem that women have with traditional religious formulations.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. I mean, if you have a religious need or a religious consciousness, okay, you need community, you need some sense of ultimacy, you need a location where religion can operate, if we define religion as a means of ultimate transformation. So you've got certain kinds of religious needs and desires, and at the same time, you have feminist identifications or needs and desires in terms of autonomy and freedom and so on and so forth. When you look around and try to see how you would combine those things, how would you bring your feminist needs and your religious needs together, I think some women have felt that they can't do that in any kind of traditional setting, that the only way to do that is to leave all kinds of traditional religion behind, Christian, Jewish, Catholic, whatever, and to go off and to find or to refind, create or recreate what they see as the most ancient religion of all, and that is goddess religion, that the original divine figures were maternal. There have been several books arguing that, these maternal, biophilic, peaceful societies existed in the ancient world. And so some women, I think, have been attracted to a religion for women or a religion with female divine figures. You're not going to find that in Judaism or the Catholic Church or traditional Christianity or Islam. So they go back to find it in goddess religion or what they think of as goddess religion.
How much of goddess worship do you think is based on rigorous history, and how much of it do you think is based more on wishful thinking or on a romantic view of the past?
The evidence that we have for these ancient matriarchies or for so-called goddess religion is pre-literate. That is, there are no texts. This is a kind of prehistorical moment. So people who are constructing or reconstructing goddess worship do it on the basis of pottery and sometimes on the basis of myths and legends and stuff like that. So its most vulnerable spot is its historical verification. It is not, in my opinion, a historical religion. Some critics have said it's a romantic recreation of the past. That might be. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I think there's a prejudice that a religion can only be genuine or only be good for people if it's historically verifiable. I think it's possible for people to be religiously happy with something that's not historically verifiable. I think there's a way in which myths and poetry and things like that can help us to rethink where we are now, and I think that's good.
Have you been to goddess rituals or ceremonies? And I wonder what's moved you or struck you from those.
I have not been to. I do not find that an attractive option for myself. And as I say in this book, I taught a course here a few years ago, and in a sort of half-hearted attempt to bring in the goddess perspective, I think I had, you know, I did one reading or something like that, and I really think, I'd like to think of a way to put this on the air. I really blew it off in class. I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. I just sort of indicated that a lot of people were critical of this. And I had four or five students that were, they were angry. A couple of them were in tears. I'm trying to say to myself, what's going on here? What's going on here? And they were goddess worshipers, okay? I teach a course here on Christianity. I'm real sensitive to fundamentalist kids and to conservative Christians. And I know the sorts of things that upset them, and I don't tend to say that. But I think I wasn't prepared to see these goddess believers in my class. And because of that, and because of getting in conversations with them, I helped to put together a whole conference here at Indiana University on neo-paganism. And so I wrote that paper that's in my book on the goddess. But that is not out of personal desire. It was really an effort, I think, to be as fair as I could in looking at all the options that I could see.
Now, you've also written about women who are reinterpreting the religious text. Instead of forming like a new religion or going back to goddess worship, they're trying to just reinterpret the Bible and other religious texts to find more equality for women written within those texts? A better place for women?
It's kind of, you know, Mary Daly, I think, said a lot of years ago, if you took all the good parts of women out of the Bible and just put them into one little book, you'd have a pamphlet. it's hard to go back and take a book that has been shaped by cult and war and ritual and legalism that has purposely left women out and do much of a reinterpretation. On the other hand, critics like Phyllis Trible and people who work in biblical texts say that there's a lot more feminine imagery in the Bible than translators even allow for. You know, I mean, we're looking at a Bible in English because that's our language. When you go back and look up these words in Hebrew and so forth, apparently there's a lot more feminine resonance in some of those texts than we are led to believe. I'm still not sanguine about that as an option. I mean, I think we're probably, push comes to shove, going to find that this book is not particularly great for women.
What do you find most interesting on the revisionary front?
On the revisionary front right now, the most interesting book that's been written is a book by Elizabeth Johnson called She Who Is, arguing that we really have got that when the bottom line on all this stuff is the God symbol. And we have thought about God in exclusively male language and in masculine terms, king, warrior, lawgiver, he, him, and so on and so forth. Now, there are a group of people now who are arguing that that is a blasphemy, that really, if I can put it this way, gives God the short shrift, that basically metaphors about God are not God, they're just suggestions. We can never contain the divine in our language, and so we use our language to come up with what we think is the best approximation. And most language about God is anthropomorphic, that it's based on human experience and human symbols in some way. Well, the human symbols and human experience that have been exclusively used to talk about God are male or masculine. And so I think this argument would say what we want to do is to bring in symbols and experiences that are feminine, and that it's not good enough just to use the kind of language that never refers to God as he, using some kind of neutral language, but that in fact we really must refer to God as she and her will and so on, and him together, so that we come up with a much more balanced picture.
Do you ever think that it would be better to find some kind of neutral language to refer to God instead of he or she?
No.
God without gender? God transcending gender?
No, I don't really think so. Or, you know, as one of my graduate school professors used to say to me, when you're really in trouble, you don't say, oh, ground of my being, hasten to help me. You know, that these abstractions somehow take away from the central insight that we have about the deity, and that is that God has got a personality and is personally involved in our lives in one way or the other. And I think to constantly be referring to divinity, as I'm doing now, in these abstract kinds of terms rather than in more anthropomorphic language, has got its own dangers.
Mm-hmm. Have you found a place for yourself within the church?
Myself? I find going to church sometimes profoundly uncomfortable. But that shouldn't be a huge problem. The language sometimes is bothersome to me, and sometimes it's not. I think I'm more bothered now by the fact that people seem to fiddle with the liturgy so much. You know, the it's very hard to, in my opinion at least, find a good liturgy that should waft you away and do certain things if you participate in it. Now I find it very kind of distracting. So my issues with the church are sometimes feminist, and they're sometimes really just more liturgical.
Well, you've described your own situation as one of spiritual homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't sure if you even go to church anymore.
Yes, I go to church. But I also am a kind of, I'm a pluralist person. I celebrate Passover with my surrogate family here, and I go to a lot of different churches. I go over to the AME church here 2 or 3 times a year. I go to the Catholic church. I think my connections with Catholicism probably are through, as it suggests in that book, through that kind of stream of religious experience that runs through what I think are the best parts of the Catholic mystical tradition.
How satisfying is it to go to services of different religions and different denominations as opposed to being affiliated with only one?
I feel affiliated with only mm-hmm. one. That's not it. I mean, I think if you're my age and Catholic, it's probably hard to be anything else.
Yeah.
If you've you know, this, I'm 50 years old, and being an ex-Catholic is probably not an option. And so I do not feel satisfied. I would not want to be anything besides what I am. I do, however, feel no constraints in terms of celebrating with other people in their traditions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Jo Weaver. She's the author of the new book, Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today. She's a professor of religious studies and women's studies at Indiana University. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Mary Jo Weaver is my guest, author of a new book on spiritual survival for Catholic women today. Do you think that women have any hope of ordination within the Catholic Church?
No, I really don't. I keep trying. I gave the keynote address at the 10th anniversary of the Women's Ordination Conference, and my assessment of the historical situation then, which was 1985, remains the same. That is that women can stay in the church and wait to be ordained, and I don't see that happening in my lifetime. They can go to a Protestant church and be ordained and maybe not find a ministry. I don't know if they'll find that satisfying. Or they can basically try to respond to those communities that feel really still sacramental and in need of someone to celebrate with them and yet slightly off to the margins or askew or formally heretical to the Catholic Church and celebrate the Eucharist with them.
The most important woman in the imagery and symbolism of the Church is Mary. What are some of the controversies today over Mary's role in the Church?
I think, Mary, because we don't know anything about her really historically, except that she's the mother of Jesus. I mean, she's never mentioned by name in the New Testament, except in that context. And so where we don't know a lot, I think the imagination fills in. And I think the imagination fills in on the right and on the left. It's as it has filled in through history. So in some sectors, Mary, I think, is a very conservative, if not reactionary, symbol. Various Marian apparitions, not just at Medjugorje in Europe, but also there are various Marian apparitions going on in this country right now, all over the United States at various sites. Most of the messages of those things are traditional and conservative. That is, Mary speaking against rock music, Mary speaking against abuses in the church, Mary speaking against abortion, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, I think on the left you have people who will take a text like the Magnificat in the Gospel of Luke, "My soul proclaims the greatness of the Lord. My spirit rejoices in God my Savior. He has raised up the lowly from the earth, and he has cast down the mighty," as a kind of text of liberation theology or empowerment. Mary becomes a figure in some communities of the unwed mother, who was poor and a serving woman and kicked around and misunderstood and so on and so forth. So I think there's a whole sector there that can identify with her. I think there's a whole goddess motif around Mary, that a lot of the attributes of Mary in traditional Catholicism are rereadings or borrowings from certain kinds of things that we would find in the myth of Aphrodite or Venus or this or that or the other thing. I think in the traditional Catholic liturgy, there are all kinds of titles for Mary, you know, as Queen of Heaven and Tower of Ivory and Tower of David and things like that, that probably could be used, I think, to support Catholic women who are searching to find ways to maintain themselves and their feminism at the same time. So she's a very malleable, very plastic symbol, in my opinion.
You think of Jesus' attitude toward women as essentially positive and empowering. What have you found in the Bible that leads you to that conclusion?
Jesus treats women pretty much as equals. I mean, a normal man in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus probably shouldn't be speaking to women, should not be taking them particularly seriously, and should assume that they're going to sit home or stay home and cook and not do anything else. He's got these women followers. I mean, when he goes to the Samaritan woman, he goes and engages in a conversation with her that's kind of unheard of. He assumes that women are going to follow him or are going to be his disciples or are going to be empowering. If we look at a figure like Mary Magdalene, who has been used oftentimes by male interpreters is the figure of the prostitute or the, you know, the hysteric, something like that. Let's look at that in a different way. I mean, what we have here is someone who's a friend of Jesus, the first person to whom he appeared. So in that way, the first of the apostles, someone who has got some clout and authority in the early church, it looks like, in one way, shape, or form. So I think there's a lot of positive things there.
What led you to studying theology as opposed to becoming trying to find a life within the church?
I did not study theology originally. I was a chemist, and I worked for a pharmaceutical chemical company for several years, and decided I did not want to do that forever. It was sort of an exalted way of being a cook, really, an organic chemist. So I wanted to go to graduate school, and this was right in the mid-60s when the council was just happening. I had always been interested in religion. I find the questions raised by religion in terms of culture and history and images and all those things fascinating. So I went back and got a PhD in theology after several years of working in a chemistry lab because I was interested in the questions. I've never been interested in any kind of professional life. I mean, I don't think I would want to be a priest, although I like preaching. I've done that a couple times, but I don't think I'm pastorally inclined. I like to teach, and I like to think, and I like to write.
Now, at what point did you also become interested in feminist issues, and what initial impact did that have on your religious studies?
I think if I had allowed myself to think much about feminist issues when I was a graduate student, I probably would have lost my mind. I was at Notre Dame, where I think there were 3 bathrooms for women on campus, and that's not a little teeny-weeny campus. And I just sort of went blissfully through that place not thinking about it and letting male professors say things like, well, we'll repeat this for Mary Jo because she really hasn't had that much Latin or stuff like that. I just didn't pay attention, period. And then my first job was in a seminary. I taught for 3 years in a seminary. And there, I think that atmosphere really was patriarchy at its finest, in all kinds of ways, insidious and kind of sugar-coated in various ways. I was quite in tune with that. Then when I came to Indiana University in 1975, people asked me how I could possibly be a feminist and a Catholic at the same time.
What would you say?
I would say I don't know, but I can do it. I think it can be done. That's what really led to my first book, New Catholic Women, having these conversations with people here who said, well, how do you hold that together? How do people hold it together? See, I think there's some assumption here, oftentimes by liberals, that religion is something you can just sort of fop off. You know, religion is a pain in the neck. Therefore, I won't have anything to do with it. I won't practice it. I don't think one can do that so easily. I mean, literature hasn't been great for women, but you just can't throw it over and say, well, that's it. There is no literature. History hasn't been great for women. You can't just throw it over. I don't think you can just throw over religion either. So I've been a lot more interested all the time in trying to see how you could make these things work together. And if it doesn't look like it can work together in the structure, then what can you do in your own life to enhance your religious life without selling out your feminist principles?
I know one of the women in Catholicism that has meant a lot to you is Teresa of Avila. I don't really know anything about her. Tell me something about her and what you've found in her story that resonates with you.
Teresa of Avila is a 16th century Spanish nun, a Carmelite, who probably led a jolly little life for a while and then had some kind of illness or something. I don't really know a whole lot about her person. I don't think much about her personal story. Her personal story doesn't interest me. She became a reformer, and she did all these kind of reforms in the Carmelite order. What's important about Teresa for me is that she, in her contemplative experience, she's a mystic and a contemplative. She's got a kind of prayer of quiet. In Teresa of Avila's prayer, in her understanding of God, God is located inside the self, at the deepest center of our self, waiting for us to get in touch, as it were. And that we find God in ourselves by way of quiet prayer and contemplation. We don't have to be doing all these other kinds of things. And this God at the center of ourselves is passionately loving and affirming and cares about us, and really is just longing for relationship with us, as we, in fact, should be longing for relationship with God. So that's Teresa's, I think, major insight is that God within us, and that's what's attracted me to it.
I guess that relates to what you were saying before, that you were interested in the mystical stream.
Yeah, that's it. That's been my way to sort of, if I don't agree with or find myself put in a quandary by what a particular bishop says, what the Pope says, and so forth, I think I find in contemplative prayer and in the mystical streams of Catholicism a retreat, a place to go, and a place to get myself refreshed.
Mary Jo Weaver is the author of Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today. She teaches at Indiana University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, childcare and women's rights. We talk with Mary Frances Berry about her new book, The Politics of Parenthood. Berry was raised by a poor single mother. Berry spent part of her childhood in an orphanage while her mother looked for work. There were no daycare options. Also, The Dialectic of Sex, the early feminist book by Shulamith Firestone, is back in print. Our critic Maureen Corrigan has just reread it, and she has a different reaction than she did the first time around. She'll tell us why. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton was engaged in efforts today in Washington to gain public support for the part of his economic plan that calls for new spending. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Mr. Clinton went before a meeting of the National League of Cities to tout the job-creating effects of both his short-term stimulus plan, which would boost the deficit by spending more this year on jobs programs and infrastructure projects, and his $169 billion long-term program of new spending and tax cuts. And an hour later, he met with members of the House Budget Committee who have been focusing on his spending programs as a place to eke out some more budget savings. The president agreed to delay implementing some of his longer-range spending programs, and leaders of the Senate and House budget committees who met with the president at the White House today said they expected to pare an additional $50 billion or more from the president's programs over 5 years. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
According to officials at the State Department, a number of nations, including the United States, are moving to tighten sanctions against Serbia. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says these moves include blocking transfers of money. And for the second time in 3 days, officials have taken actions against certain ships believed to have been involved in violations of current sanctions against Serbia. U.S. officials have been concerned about the ability of Serbia to get around sanctions imposed just last year. Although they have increased shortages and inflation in the country, they have not led to a peace agreement. The Japanese ambassador to the United States told an audience in Detroit today that it would be unfair for the Clinton administration to increase tariffs on Japanese-made minivans by reclassifying them as trucks. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Ambassador Takakazu Kuriyama was very much the diplomat in his speech before the Economic Club of Detroit, stressing the common interests his country and the United States have. But he did criticize the proposal backed by the domestic auto industry, which would raise the tariff on import minivans from the current 2.5% per vehicle to 25%. The ambassador said that would amount to a tax of several thousand dollars on middle-class Americans who purchased the minivans.
I fail to understand why this 1,000% increase in the tariff is necessary when the big three already control 92% of the minivan market in this country.
Ford Chairman Harold Poling responded that since minivans are considered trucks by federal safety regulators, then they should also be classified as trucks for import purposes, making them subject to the higher tariff. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 65 points to close at a record high of 3,469.42 on volume of more than 276 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, the nation's military leader has led peace talks and ordered his troops to attack in the eastern part of the nation in a new effort to get to thousands of civilians there. A Serbian leader had ordered his forces to allow civilians to leave two areas now under siege, but he said that wounded soldiers could not leave. This new order to attack ended a unilateral ceasefire declared several weeks ago by government forces. The government says that towns now under its control in the area are suffering from a lack of food and ammunition. Yesterday, UN Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali said a failure of the warring factions to accept a peace agreement might mean UN members would have to send troops on the ground in order to force a settlement. Members of the European community have postponed a sensitive vote on the farm trade deal agreed to last year between the United States and EC nations. The government of France had threatened to veto this agreement. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The farm trade deal was scheduled to be voted on today in Brussels at a meeting of EC foreign ministers. The meeting covered a number of transatlantic trade disputes that have soured relations with Washington. But with France threatening to use its veto, the EC postponed the vote. A French veto could provoke a major crisis in the EC. The French say the deal hurts them the most since they are Europe's largest agricultural producer. But other EC countries, including Germany, say the deal includes many concessions by the United States. French President François Mitterrand visits the U.S. tomorrow, mainly to talk about trade issues. French officials fear an EC-U.S. trade war could be on the horizon. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry reporting.
Singer and band leader Billy Eckstine has died in Pittsburgh at the age of 78. Known as Mr. B, he had a number of hits in the 40s and 50s, among them Everything I Have Is Yours and I Apologize. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Can women be equal if they have to assume more than equal responsibility for raising their children? Mary Frances Berry thinks not. In her new book, The Politics of Parenthood, she goes back through history to see how today's assumptions about parenting compare to those of the past. Berry is a lawyer, a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She writes, "Despair compelled me to write this book. I asked, what kind of despair?"
The despair expressed by my students and by friends of mine who seemed to believe that women absolutely have to take care of children, and even if they have jobs, and no matter what their other responsibilities are, and that this is not something that men necessarily have to do or regard as part of their lives, and a frustration that friends, students, people expressed about this being the case, but believing that it was preordained and that it had always been that way, and that it's very, very difficult to change it, even as some people are trying to change it today. And then I did this research on the history of child care and women's rights and found out that in point of fact, that in the colonial period and the early part of the history of this country, that fathers played a much more important role in caring for children than they do today, and that that was generally understood to be the right thing to do, and men even enjoyed doing it, and that the children were no worse off or better off than having it be otherwise.
This was men who worked close to home on a farm or
whatever? In point of fact, before the Industrial Revolution in this country, and before the Industrial Revolution, almost everyone worked at home. It was the Industrial Revolution that took people out from home and greater urbanization. And in that kind of context, mothers worked at things that we send to clothes we send to the dry cleaners today, or preparing food, all kinds of things around the house that had to be done, household industries. Fathers worked either in agricultural pursuits or even if they were professionals and were lawyers, for example. People worked at home. Children were there. They were around, they could do it. And in point of fact, the religion, the religious reasons played a role too, because in the colonial period, the understanding in the Protestant religion of the Puritans in New England and other people in the colonies was that women were sinful creatures who could not be trusted to give guidance to themselves, let alone their husbands. And it was necessary for the man to have dominion over them and to treat them, to teach them the right way and to teach the children the right way, so that this fit in nicely with practical circumstances, gave the opportunity for men to do it, with the fact that religion said it's a great thing to do it, and that everyone understood that this worked just as well for children as otherwise.
I will say I know several men who really do take a very active part in parenting, and also that I know several women who were really surprised by their desire to stay home with their child after they give birth. You know, by that they found themselves wanting to stay home a lot longer,
right,
than they had thought they would.
Right, that does happen, and it is also the case that anyone who spends a lot of time around an infant. Infants are very charming creatures. Will bond with that infant. If fathers do it, they will bond. If people who are not even relatives, nannies and other people who grandparents, will bond with an infant. It makes sense that a woman who has a baby and who has the infant there with her a great deal will find it engaging, will love it, will want to be around it. But the point is that if it's not possible to do so, or if the mother doesn't believe that she should do so or has something else to do, then in fact one shouldn't feel that the child will be neglected, the child won't be happy, the child will complain, because children, if they are taken care of by people who care for them and who love them, and it's quality care, will respond to that and will thrive.
What do you think policy and business need to do to catch up to the changes in the family?
What needs to happen is for more employers to provide child care at the work site. We need more family and medical leave or parental leave, but we need also paid leave, because unpaid leave is wonderful compared to no leave at all. But for people who can't afford it, even when they get health care paid for when they're off from work, they just can't forego the income, not being able to work. So we need that. We need standards for the child care services that are available, that are enforced. And even if we have all of those things, and I point this out in my book, even if you have all of those things available, an employer who gives child care, a good leave policy, and the rest of it, so long as women continue to think that they are principally responsible for the care of their offspring and worry that they ought to be there and feel torn about it and don't understand that this is a role that has to be shared with others, and that there's nothing wrong with it, and it won't hurt the children. We need all of those things, both on the policy side and on different, we need different perspectives from women concerning their lives.
My guest is Mary Frances Berry. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Frances Berry, author of The Politics of Parenthood. Can I ask you about your own family when you were growing up and
Sure.
your upbringing? I've read that your mother had to put you and a brother in an orphanage when you were young. What happened?
My father left. He abandoned the family. My mother's story about it is that he couldn't find work and he was embarrassed because he was not able to be the breadwinner, and there were all kinds of problems. And he abandoned the family, and my mother did not have the resources to take care of us. And so she put us, and other relatives were too poor to take up the slack. They tried, but they had their own problems. So she put us in this orphanage while she went to beauty school so that she could learn trade and be able to take care of us. And so we were there in the orphanage while she went to school. And she would visit us in the orphanage, and lots of terrible things happened to us. You know, it was a real sort of Charles Dickens kind of story, being exploited by the people who ran this particular orphanage. We didn't tell our mother because we didn't want to upset her, but it was one of the most chilling experiences in my life, and it shows what happens when you don't get good child care.
It sounds like your orphanage was the equivalent of the daycare center for your mother, who couldn't have afforded any such thing,
right,
even if there was one.
Yeah, it was the exploitative, the worst kind of exploitative daycare center, yeah.
So what happened to you in the orphanage? How were you mistreated?
Well, one of the men, the place was run by males, and one of the men who ran it we were very hungry all the time. They saved money by not buying food in quantities for us to eat. They would, for example, pour water into the milk and make all the kids line up. I remember this every morning. We would have to say, "Thank you, God, Jesus, for this food," while we drank this watered-down milk. And they would buy rotten chicken parts thrown out at the store and make stew with lots and lots of black pepper in it so you couldn't taste it. So we were hungry all the time. One of my earliest memories is my brother, who was a year older than I am, crying because he was hungry at night. And one of the men who ran the place used to buy himself food steak, pork chops, and the like, and then he would sell the bones to the children. If your mother came on Sunday and gave you a nickel or something, he would offer to sell these bones to the poor kids who were there who didn't have anything else to eat. So I will never forget, it's one of the most poignant memories of my life, the crying, my brother's crying and always being hungry. And I used to say to people that I wished I had eaten more. Maybe I would have been tall. I always wanted to be very tall, and I have this dream that if I had had a lot to eat, I would be really tall.
I don't mean to disappoint you, but I ate my share as a kid, and I'm real short.
I guess it doesn't work.
Didn't help me. How did your mother explain it to you when she put you in the orphanage? How old were you?
I don't remember the explanation, because I must have been about three, I guessed. And my brother was a year older. He remembers better than I all the details of this. And he says that she, you know, and she tells me later, I remember from later, that she took us there because she didn't want to. It hurt her more than anything. But she took us there because she had no other alternative at that time. And so we had to stay there until she finished this course. And then she took us and got a place for us to live and worked as a cosmetologist, a beauty beautician in the back room of this house we lived in. And she worked at that for a number of years.
So how old were you when she took you out of the orphanage?
Oh, I must have been, four and a half, maybe, five, perhaps.
Were you angry with her?
No. I don't have the, I have this stoicism about things, and I don't remember ever being angry about it. I remember mostly being sad, about it most of my, life as a child. Being sad because, I basically missed a childhood. I didn't have much of a childhood. Even after that, we were very poor and it was not a very pleasant time. So I missed the childhood.
Now, how did you start to get serious about education?
Well, my mother, who graduated from the eighth grade and then had the cosmetology school, had more education than anybody else in her family. She was the youngest of 12 children, and the rest of them didn't go to beyond the fourth, fifth grade. And she didn't go to high school because there was no high school for African-Americans in the town where she lived. But she always told us, you know, you're going to school, and I liked going to school. And that you should go as far as you can. And even her brothers and sisters sent their children to school. Almost everybody among my cousins went to college, even though none of our parents did. And I don't know where they got the idea from, but it certainly was a great one, and I'm glad they did it.
You went to Howard University.
Right.
Now, growing up in a really poor neighborhood, what was your schooling like in grade school?
Grade school, my brother and I walked. First of all, we went to a school which was in our neighborhood, which had one room and a teacher who taught all the grades through the sixth grade, and who cooked a very wonderful smelling pot of beans on the stove, which was one of those heaters that you put coal in the room while we were being taught our lessons in the morning so that you could have it for lunch. And you'd sit there smelling the bean soup cooking while she taught us. She taught all the grades in that room. Then after that, my mother decided that we should go to a better school, which was some miles away. It took us about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours, to walk to this other school, which was inside the city. And so my brother and I and my cousin would walk to this school every morning. It was quite an expedition. But my mother explained to us that we should be willing to do this because when she was little and lived out in the country, her father took her down to the creek every morning and brought their horse and put her on the horse, and the horse took her across. And then she had to walk for miles and miles, and then they'd come back and get her at the end of the day, and the horse would bring her across to the other side, so that we shouldn't complain about having to walk all the way to the school. People talk about school busing. There was no bus to take us to this school, and we went there. And then we went to junior high school and high school in Nashville and had some wonderful teachers. I was privileged to have wonderful teachers. I had some that were not that good. You hear some African Americans talk about in the old days of segregation, all the schools were good and all the teachers were wonderful. That's not true. But I was lucky enough in particular to have a wonderful teacher in high school whose name was Minerva Azalea Johnson. And she taught me and inspired me and told me that I was a really a smart person and that I could go to college. And she told me that this was that I would be wonderful, I'd do well at it. And she gave me books to read and spent hours with me when we were not even in school, talking to me about what I'd read and so on. She regarded me as a diamond in the rough, as she put it. And so I'm very grateful to her.
I should mention here that you were you are the former president of, I forget which university it is.
I was chancellor of the University of Colorado at Boulder, in Boulder, Colorado.
So you kind of came a long way from from a one-room schoolhouse to the head of a university.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
I want to get back to the politics of parenthood. Do you think that your personal experience in the orphanage when you were young and watching your mother struggle to eke out a living and take care of the kids influenced your decision to research the subject and to become something of an activist in it?
Well, I think it clearly, the experience clearly influenced me to become an activist in causes, to become a cause person in terms of the rights of all people. And so writing the book came directly from that interest. And I suppose at a subliminal level, being aware of my mother's struggle to balance jobs and children and being aware of what that meant and the historic struggle of African-American women to do this influenced some of the things that I wrote in the book and made me aware of how this has been a festering problem for a long time and not one of 20th century origin.
Mary Frances Berry is the author of The Politics of Parenthood. This is Fresh Air. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we'll have a report from Mara Liasson on President Clinton's speech to the League of Cities. He has apparently enlisted most of the mayors in favor of his economic plan and is asking them to sell it to members of Congress. Prime Minister John Major in Great Britain is suing a newspaper for libel. We'll have a report from Michael Goldfarb on libel laws in Britain. We'll also have an update from Waco and talk to an expert on fundamentalists and cults in the United States and elsewhere. And we'll have a report from Suni Khalid on terror in the United States. We'll also be remembering Billy Eckstein, who died today. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The magazine Publishers Weekly took a survey of feminist bookstores across the country last year and asked proprietors to name the 20 most influential women's books of the last two decades. One book kept coming up that was no longer in print. Shulamith Firestone's The Dialectic of Sex was originally published in 1970, and though booksellers considered it a feminist classic, it was unavailable to the new generation of feminists. Well, that's changed as of this month. The William Morrow Company has re-released a new edition of The Dialectic of Sex to coincide with International Women's Month. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
One advantage to having a head cold when doing this appreciation of The Dialectic of Sex is that nobody can accuse me of sounding shrill. Shrill, strident, frigid, freakish, those were the insults that critics hurled at radical feminists like Shulamith Firestone back in the 1970s, when the second wave of the women's movement was gathering force. It would be interesting to know what Firestone thinks of the current modes of feminist backlash. It would also be interesting to know what she's made of her adult life. Firestone was only about 24 when she wrote this incendiary book. But unfortunately, Shulamith Firestone is the J.D. Salinger of radical feminism. Right after The Dialectic of Sex appeared in 1970, she dropped out of the women's movement. She refused to write an updated introduction for this new edition, nor will she consent to interviews. Aside from reclusiveness, Firestone has something else in common with Salinger. Like him, she managed to write a book that serves as a time capsule for its age. If you really want to get a feel for what The Dialectic of Sex once meant to a lot of women, you have to dig up an old edition, the one with hype phrases like these on the cover. A slashing attack on male supremacy. Chapter 6 might change your life. These days, the only books that promise to change your life are diet and makeover manuals. But 20 years ago, Firestone was writing in a climate of political activism that made her vision of a feminist revolution seem almost plausible. What Firestone had in mind was something more audacious than a neatly contained International Women's Day. She wanted to rechart the future of the human race. Drawing heavily on the work of Marx and Engels, she argued that the world's women constituted one gigantic sex class. The biological differences between men and women were responsible for the sexual imbalance of power that Firestone claimed had afflicted every culture since the dawn of time. Her solutions? She urged women to seize the means of reproduction, and she didn't just mean birth control. Firestone envisioned a world liberated by science where artificial reproduction would rescue women from the tyranny of pregnancy. She dreamt of pansexual group households, which would replace the nuclear family, and of R2-D2 cyborgs that would remedy the unequal division of labor between the sexes by ending human labor altogether. In the soaring conclusion of her book, Firestone sounded like William Morris, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and every other utopian dreamer when she proclaimed that we now have the knowledge to create a paradise on Earth. It's hard to imagine who the audience will be for this new edition of The Dialectic of Sex. These days, even most of the women's studies majors I teach think that Naomi Wolf is too radical. Still, for all its wild generalizations and leaden rhetoric, Firestone's book is also touchingly impassioned. It might be worth a reread for women of a certain age. It'll help you remember that there was once a time when you felt you could talk about feminism without apology.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed the new edition of The Dialectic of Sex by Shulamith Firestone. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, creating TV programs, we meet Tom Fontana, executive producer of the new TV series Homicide. He was producer and head writer of St. Elsewhere. I'm Jerry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.